Hey friends, Chuck Mingo here. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Living Undivided. As you know, I lead a racial solidarity and justice movement called Undivided. And part of that is a 6-week experience called Living Undivided that really leans into the uncomfortable but necessary conversations we need to have around race in our country. You know, whether you are feeling like, gosh, I'm fatigued with this conversation, or you're like, I'm not sure that I even want to step into this conversation because I'm not sure what can happen and what can change. Every week on this show, we want to encourage you. We want to encourage you to lean into this conversation, because what started in 2015 for Undivided has led to 7,000 people leaning in on this conversation around race and finding unity, finding unexpected grace, and actually finding that they can organize and mobilize to affect justice for other people and themselves. And so we are inspiring you to lean into this space. And every week we do that by helping introduce you to a guest who is doing just that. So I'm really excited about today's show, as I always am, but specifically today, because I'm sure you can see it. You know, if you're listening to this on a podcast, you can't, but if you're watching on Facebook, I got more and more of these gray hairs around my goatee. I got more of these gray hairs popping up in my head. So as I get older in this space, I really want to be listening to Gen X, Gen Y, I am Gen X, Gen Y, and others who are coming into this space to understand what their heart is and what they're seeing. And today, we're going to get a chance to do that with an up-and-coming leader in this space who is certainly younger than me and passionate about this work. Her name is Michaela Clark. She actually grew up in College Hill in Cincinnati, Ohio, my adopted hometown. She also attended the church that I pastored, Crossroads. And so she actually has been at Crossroads Church from kind of her days as a kid all the way through college. And so she went to college at DePaul University, and she completed her bachelor's degree there in 2019. Check out her double major. She double majored in African and Black Diaspora Studies and also Peace, Justice, and Conflict Studies. So that tells you a little bit about her heart in this space. At DePaul, she's facilitated restorative justice workshops, participated in Inside Out Prison Exchange program. She was active in community service at the Gary Comer Youth Center while she was there. And then she's currently living in Montgomery, Alabama, to complete a 2-year racial justice fellowship. And in that fellowship, she's actually been researching racial lynchings across the U.S. and working with communities on truth-telling efforts. There's so much that we're going to learn today, and so much I want to lean into today. And I should also say, outside of her work in this space, she's also engaged in the moment, talking about what it looks like to reimagine policing outside of just the police force, reimagine public safety in Montgomery, Alabama. So lots that we're going to cover in this conversation on Living Undivided with my guest, Michaela Clark. Let's welcome Michaela now.
Thanks so much for having me, Chuck, and thanks for all of the kind words. I should say that I'm borderline millennial. I was born in 96, so <All right. laughs> not quite Gen X, but yeah.
Borderline millennial. I like that. I like that. Well, Michaela, let's just start in the beginning. So just get, you know, I gave a little bit of your kind of thumb sketch background, but talk about, you know, you growing up, your background. Give us a little bit of context for you growing up.
Yeah, so I grew up in Cincinnati all my life, spent in Cincinnati, Ohio. Shout out my parents, Edward and Kathy Clark, who are part of the Undivided family in Crossroads.
Yes, they are.
And I should mention that my time that I spent at Crossroads, we came to Crossroads when I was entering high school. And immediately I was drawn in by the Unbound student movement.
Oh, yeah.
And thinking about human trafficking and organizing around that space. And that was a formative experience for me, because that was the first exposure to student movement that I've ever experienced. So I do want to raise that and give a shout out to those organizers.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the organizers of that, she just recently got married and kind of has a family now. So you're bringing back memories. I should have worn my Unbound shirt if I'd have known that. I still have the shirt with the dove on it from that movement. So that's pretty cool to know that that was for you maybe an early exposure to the kind of work that you're doing now.
Absolutely.
Super cool. Super cool. Okay.
Yeah. I don't have much to add. I left Cincinnati when I came to college. but still have those Midwestern roots. Mm-hmm. So I was always interested in, even growing up, going to the Freedom Center every year in school and thinking about this idea of enslavement and how that happened in the United States, but also how it evolved into this modern day slavery, human trafficking movement. Yes. And so that's always been just at the forefront of my organizing. And even in high school, I was doing a project on human trafficking and fair labor practices and dreaming about how I can contribute to dismantling that system. So I feel like all of these different things about my upbringing and life are connected into this current moment. And it just is a shout out to my roots in Cincinnati. So
absolutely. And it sounds like then you went into college with a vision that this is at least the space you want to get into. And so maybe that explains your very strategically chosen dual majors. So talk a little bit about, what made you go that route with both of those majors? What were you hoping to accomplish, and how maybe did that help to form you even further down the path?
Yeah. So one of the main reasons I chose to go to DePaul University in Chicago was for the Peace, Justice, and Conflict Studies program. I had never seen anything like that. I was very interested in peace building and restorative justice and transformative justice.
And can I pause and ask you, because those are terms that oftentimes might be new to people. So just give us a definition of those three terms. Peace building, what do you mean by restorative justice? What do you mean by transformative justice?
Yeah, so restorative justice, it's oftentimes used in the criminal justice space, but it's essentially a way of being. It's often used in conversations about conflict resolution and kind of getting back, restoring the relationship, getting back to what the relationship was before it was broken, essentially. Mm-hmm. Transformative justice, I think, is a philosophy that I'm embracing more and more as a practice and a way of being, because transformative justice reimagines what society could be. Like, how are we addressing harm? How are we thinking outside of this criminal justice space? So, transformative justice gets to the root of the community. It's not just about the individual. It's about the entire community and how are we transforming and improving and healing all together. Mm-hmm. And I think peace building ties into both aspects, both restorative and transformative justice. Mm-hmm. It's building up relationships to be nonviolent and to combat oppressive systems. Mm-hmm. So that we can reimagine what Black liberation looks like in the future, and that we are actively creating that together. We're actively creating this new possible future.
Yeah. What I love in the collection of all of those is it's about relationship. I'm hearing a little bit of echo too. It's about relationship. And it's also, I'm hearing, it's a participatory effort. So this isn't something that we do solo, and it isn't something that we depend on others to do, but collectively we're engaged in this work. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Right. It's definitely all about building something as a community. And I lean on my favorite quote by one of my favorite people, Audre Lorde: without community, there is no liberation. And that has been a mantra. It has definitely shaped all of the work that I do thus far, that we need each other. We need to lean into each other to create something new. And a new world is possible. Absolutely.
Yes. And so you're doing this work at an interesting time in our country, obviously, given the racial reckoning of 2020, but also you're doing it in an interesting place because you've moved from Cincinnati to Montgomery, Alabama, which obviously, as we think about the civil rights movement in the 60s, was one of the epicenters for sure of a lot of the work. Obviously, Rosa Parks, the Montgomery bus boycott. I mean, there's so much history there. So I wonder, as you look through the lens of the work you're doing now, what are you seeing in this moment, Michaela? What are you seeing as the needs What are you seeing as the challenges, and where are you kind of getting energized in the work that you're doing?
Yeah, it's been such an honor and a pleasure to be in this space with all of these amazing organizers. And we do have a rich history here in Montgomery with the civil rights movement. And it's an extremely unique place to be, even though the civil rights movement ended. But I've had the pleasure of being in conversation with organizers who are carrying on that legacy. And this past weekend, we just celebrated the anniversary of the bus boycott. And those conversations brought that history to the present and how we are carrying on that legacy. It didn't just end with Rosa Parks, but it continued with the work that she laid the foundation for. And I think it's really interesting when talking with folks about my move from the Midwest to the South, I would get the comments were just kind of insane to me. Just like, why are you moving to the South? And what, people are racist in the South. And I'm like, you know, people are racist in the Midwest too.
That's right, that's right. And the East and the West.
Everywhere, yes. Mm-hmm. And so I've just really had the pleasure of seeing folks here and seeing the work that goes in, the work that has been put in by Black queer folks, Black trans folks, Black women who are holding this movement on their shoulders, bringing everyone to the forefront and doing the bulk of this organizing work. And we saw what happened in Georgia a couple weeks ago, and Georgia's in the South, and to have that moment where the work of Black women was recognized, and that pushing forward for this election, that Georgia was able to flip like that, is incredible. And it speaks to the years and centuries of organizing that has happened here. And I just think that's a history that cannot be ignored. And I just will not allow the South to be dismissed in a way that is just so limiting to what has really been going on here. And it's difficult. We are up against more conservative thinkers. You do experience visible acts of racism and violence, but at the same time, you have all of these incredible organizers who are committed to transforming the scene.
Yeah, I love hearing you say that. And I'm reminded too that, you know, to some degree, only after things are exposed can they be healed. And so to some degree, the South, once again, is a place where maybe some of this is less subtle. But I do believe that that being out in the light is also why there's such power and strength in the organizers in the South. And there's a level of healing and leadership that's coming from the South. You know, to some degree, the politeness in which we hide our racism in the North is one of the things that allows those systems of injustice to continue. And so you're in a place where it's being exposed and you're on the front lines. And now you said something, and I wanna maybe ask you to unpack this. You talked about Black leaders kind of at the forefront of this movement. And earlier you talked about Black liberation in all of its forms. And you know, kind of counter to that is this idea of decentralizing whiteness, decentering whiteness. And that might sound threatening, certainly to white people who are listening, it might sound threatening. What do you mean by that? So talk about what you mean by that and how that actually is beneficial for everyone.
Yeah, and one of the things that I was extremely frustrated by, my mom can attest to this, earlier this summer when all these anti-racist book clubs were popping up and White Fragility was at the top of everyone's list and it was selling out all over the place. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a problem with talking about race. I think that's important, but dismantling white supremacy is about so much more than just acknowledging whiteness as a thing, or acknowledging white privilege as a thing. Because there's so much more to Black folks. We have culture, art, all of these things that go beyond this concept of race. And I think a part of dismantling white supremacy is decentering whiteness, because when white folks are at the center of the conversation, that is reinforcing the idea that whiteness is the normal, is the standard. And so a part of dismantling this larger system that affects all of us is decentralizing the conversations of whiteness. And I just think in terms of this moment too, this is not anything new. Right. And I think for a lot of white folks, maybe it was the pandemic that contributed to this uprising that we saw this summer and lots of more white people wanting to be involved. I didn't need to watch the video of George Floyd because I've seen it before. And I think it's a little bit dismissive to think of this moment as only something happening in 2020 because we've been here before. And I think a part of what is so frustrating is this historical gaslighting, to quote Professor Eddie Glaude from Princeton, he calls it this, that it's easy to think of this as a one-time moment. It's easy for white folks to exclude themselves from the complacency that has happened in the past. But I think a really important part of this conversation is acknowledging, okay, why am I getting involved right now?
Yeah.
What was happening before that I wasn't involved? And then being able to take yourself out of the equation, because whiteness can no longer be the dominant narrative, the dominant normal. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. I want to jokingly say, tell us how you really feel, Michaela. But no, I mean, I think you're bringing truth and clarity to the moment, and in a very needed and necessary perspective. So thank you. No, I think it's really helpful. I'm going to ask you to go there again, because as you know, the work that I lead is primarily rooted in faith and rooted in the church. And I really believe deeply that the church has been a place that unfortunately has been complacent more often than we've been active, the place where we haven't had these conversations more often than we have. And I believe there's an inherent power in the church, you know, go back to what you talked about with peace building and restorative justice. And I mean, those are all certainly from a Christian perspective, those are Christian ideas, not exclusively Christian ideas, but they're certainly ideas that are in our scriptures. And so what would you say to the church in this moment, as someone who grew up in a church in the Midwest, what do you want to see, or what are you seeing churches do in this moment that's encouraging you and inspiring you?
Yeah, I think what you said, it's important to realize that churches have been complacent and oftentimes implicated in this history of racial injustice. And I think what I've seen a lot of the times is churches don't want to be political. And I get that, but this is not a political issue. It's not a political conversation. The personal is political, but I think it goes beyond just choosing who the next president is. I think these conversations are so important to have within spaces like churches that are filled with people from different backgrounds, from different races. And what is that saying if the church refuses to comment on this history of racial injustice and you have Black members in your congregation and you're actively saying white is normal and the experience of whiteness in our church takes precedent over the experiences of Black members in the church. And so I think what I'm beginning to see more and more is that churches are switching the conversation, saying, okay, no, like we need to comment on this. It's not political. Right. There is a space to have these conversations because we are multiracial institutions.
Yeah. And I would imagine you've got friends across the religious spectrum and probably some friends who are not religious at all. One of my senses is that, you know, people who are not religious at all, or maybe people who are interested in faith, are looking to see how the church responds in moments like this, because in some ways it's kind of like, well, if you are who you say you are, then you'd be showing up in a loving way in these conversations. You wouldn't just be on the sidelines. And so personally, I think that the stakes for the church are also how do we communicate that we are about love and action in the way of Jesus if we're not going to engage in brokenness like we see in our country around race? Would you agree with that? Are you hearing that from your friends?
Absolutely. And I'm not going to lie, I was looking to Crossroads to see what was going to be said in this moment. I was paying attention to what was going on back home as things were happening. And I agree. Like I am connected to people who do look to the church as I wouldn't say a standard necessarily, but it's definitely a question of if this faith institution is who they say they are, then how are you responding? How are you showing up for Black lives?
Yeah.
And I think that's important to keep at the forefront and to continue to, I don't think there's anything wrong with acknowledging that, hey, maybe we didn't get it right all these
right.
years. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, with acknowledging and owning up to how the church was complacent and making a recommitment going forward.
Yeah.
How we can do better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a principle of our faith, right? It's called repentance. I mean, you know, Jesus talked about repent and believe the good news. It means to change direction. When you see you're going in a direction that isn't the way of Jesus, turn, and there's grace for that. And so I think that's a really, that's a helpful challenge for us to hear as, you know, people like me who are faith leaders to recognize this moment matters and how we respond in this moment matters. So I know we only got a couple more minutes together. I'd love to shift and talk a little bit about the work that you're doing right now. So you've moved to Montgomery to be a part of a 2-year internship there. And part of what you're doing is really documenting the lynchings that were terrorist acts that happened on our soil in America that far too often we just don't have any history of. So talk a little bit about that work, the Community Remembrance Project that you're leading for the Equal Justice Initiative and kind of what you're learning in that space.
Yeah, so I'm a justice fellow at the Equal Justice Initiative. And part of my work on the Community Remembrance Project is to research and create narrative memos that communities can use in soil collection ceremonies and installing historical markers in their communities. Actually, I just worked with Athens County, Ohio, to install a historical marker to memorialize the lynching of Mr. Christopher Davis. And that was really a powerful experience. It's so close to home. It's one of the first projects I was working on. And essentially, we want to create space where communities know this history and memorialize this person and acknowledge how it has affected their entire community. Oftentimes you hear about the Great Migration as Black folks seeking economic opportunity, and that's way oversimplified. This was a period of racial terrorism.
Absolutely.
In the South, and people were fleeing for their lives.
Yes.
From communities. And I've worked with several communities where the entire demographic was shaped by this story of a lynching. Mm-hmm. A community that I just worked with in Georgia today remained almost all white until the 90s because of the lynching that happened in the 20s.
Wow.
So we're really committed to ensuring that communities know this history and changing the landscape by erecting historical markers that tell this story, that it's a confrontation with the truth that when you visit a community, you have to know this history.
Yeah.
And so that has been a really powerful part of my experience, just seeing how various communities engage with this history and being a part of entering into this era that we're calling this truth-telling era. Because we really believe that in order to get to the reconciliation and healing, we have to be willing to tell the truth about what happened first.
Yes.
And so I've had the pleasure of working with students. We facilitate a racial justice essay contest where we award cash scholarship prizes to public high school students who write an essay about racial injustice in their community or just more broadly. And it's just been really amazing to see the unique ways in which communities choose to memorialize and choose to remember what happened to advance truth-telling and reconciliation and healing ultimately.
Wow. Wow. Such powerful work. I'm sure at times deeply emotional, but it is that restorative justice that you talked about that you're pursuing. And I love what you said. I think it's important to just emphasize that again for all of us who are listening. We cannot achieve reconciliation if there's not a reckoning, right? If there's not a reckoning for what happened. I mean, you know, I think about this again, spiritually, I can forgive someone who offends me, even if they never recognize it, right? That's between me and God. I can forgive them. I can release them of any, you know, revenge seeking, all of that. But there can't be reconciliation unless that person at some point says, hey, Chuck, I hurt you. And I want to make the relationship right. And so what you're doing through these truth telling and the soil collection and all of the things that a community is doing, it's the community's way of saying we have done wrong. And it's only when that happens at a collective level can there ever be a county in Georgia that hasn't had diversity for 70 years that gets back to it in a way that is healthy and whole for that community. So, Michaela, you're so inspiring to me because of the way that you're boldly stepping into this moment. And, you know, I just want to encourage you, like that's the vision in the heart that we would want for people who are doing Undivided, is that they would, like you did, identify a place where they're going to step in and get proximate, something I know you're very familiar with, because obviously Brian Stevenson, who leads EJI, talks about that, but where they're going to get proximate in this work. So final thoughts for you. Number one is, what would you say to someone who's maybe hearing you and inspired by your story? Where would you tell them to start that journey? What would you tell them as their next step?
Yeah, I think education is so important. I think learning about this history is so important. But also just being willing to take a step back and listen. I don't think that everyone needs to be out in the streets protesting and just claiming that you're anti-racist. This is an ongoing thing. And I really want to encourage people to think about the personal relationships in their lives where they've perpetuated violence against someone that they know. I think it's really easy to focus on these really big national, global initiatives, but I think it's just as important to be thinking about how you are dismantling systems of oppression in your personal relationships and how you're facilitating environments of healing in your personal relationships. And then along with doing your own personal research and getting with people who don't look like you and having conversations and being willing to ask questions and listen. So,
man, super practical things that we all can do. And I'm encouraged. Thank you for giving us that challenge. And I hope that all of us that are listening or watching will receive it and either continue to act toward that or begin to act in that direction. So, Michaela, final sentence for you to complete. In your words, what does it mean to live undivided?
Living undivided to me is actively working towards dismantling systems of oppression, including racism, sexism, xenophobia, transphobia, homophobia, and this list is not limited. It's dismantling those systems and recognizing how they play out in your personal relationships and ultimately politically, nationally, socially, all of these things. So everything is connected.
Yeah. Well, hey, you're doing it. You are living into your own definition. And I'm so glad that you joined us today for Living Undivided. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh man, I tell you, I am inspired by Michaela and just the intentionality of her actions. You know, for all of us, we all have a knowing and doing gap in some area in our lives, probably in many areas in our lives, but there's power when you close that gap. And what I see in Michaela that inspires me is as you learn, as you educate, as you understand more about the way that injustice works in our context and in our country, how do you close the gap between your knowledge and your action? And take a step, like she said, in your personal relationships, where you are, to live undivided. I'm encouraged to continue to do that. I hope you are as well. I'll see you next time, Living Undivided.